From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Vladimir Putin said today that Russia will not expel any American diplomats in response to the punishment the Obama administration unleashed against Russia yesterday for allegedly hacking the U.S. election. Obama said 35 Russian diplomats and their families would be expelled from the U.S., and he also announced new sanctions against Russia. The BBC's Oleg Bolduarev joins us from Moscow. And Oleg, first of all, tell us more about what President Putin said today.
Well, it looks like there is a rule book on magnanimity left somewhere in Kremlin, and Mr. Putin just found it because, it was a bit staged, because first we heard in the morning of Russian foreign minister saying he recommends to the president to expel 35 American diplomats, 31 from Moscow and 4 from St. Petersburg. And then, having thought for about an hour, Mr. Putin said he will not be doing this just now. He said this is not a time for what he called kitchen diplomacy. He said that as Russian diplomats are now flying back from the United States, Americans will stay where they are and will enjoy Happy New Year in the Russian tradition. But also he said that Russia still leaves and reserves the right to respond.
Mm. So tell us more about this. I mean, as you say, superficially, it seems as if Mr. Putin's taking the high road, but is he also buying himself some time here to craft a deeper response?
I think he's given Donald Trump time. Basically, I think everyone who is anything in Moscow spoke since yesterday night, Moscow time, when Obama administration announced their sanctions. And everyone was saying this is just a helpless and desperate gesture by the administration, which was on its way out, which hasn't achieved much. And of course, Russians are now basking in the glory of yesterday's peace agreement on Syria, feeling very high on what Russia can do, saying this actually amounts to nothing. So they give Donald Trump time to respond. I think that's why Russia is looking at Donald Trump now, seeing if he will be reversing Obama sanctions.
Now, you mentioned that the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, actually did call for the expulsion of 35 U.S. diplomats from Russia, and that, of course, President Putin decided not to do that. Why would he and Putin be on different sides of this?
I think this is just a little bit of a political theater. In the previous expulsions, there wasn't much of this toing and froing. It was just a decision to expel, and that was it. I think this was actually the prelude to letting Russians and the rest of the world know that Mr. Putin will not be acting harshly in this particular instance.
Mm. Now, remind us, what is the Russian position on the hacking allegations that the Obama administration is making?
Very shortly, you haven't proven anything. And in this particular instance, Russians are saying anyone could do this. It doesn't mean that there are some pointers towards Russia. In fact, the trail could be falsified to points towards Russia. There is no proof. And in fact, Mr. Putin was saying all along, those who accuse Russia are trying to deflect attention from the nature of the information disclosed on its own, that it's not important, Mr. Putin was saying, who cracked the DNC mail. What's important is what was left on the table after it was cracked. So going from that, obviously, Russian politicians become very incensed that from these groundless accusations, as they see it, some very harsh punishment comes out, as with yesterday's measures.
Mm. So let's talk about that for a moment, because in addition to the expulsion of the 35 Russian diplomats, the Obama administration announced sanctions, including sanctions against the Russian Security Service, Intelligence Service, the FSB. What exactly does that mean to sanction the FSB?
A lot of people are scratching their head trying to think what it is. It's not like the FSB officials are going to swim in Florida or party in Las Vegas. Every outside visit by the Russian security officials is now very tightly controlled. In fact, they're not going anywhere into any country which has an extradition treaty with the United States, clearly being afraid that they will be captured there and sent to the U.S. So it's not like they were traveling freely. It's not like they were having a lot of assets there, because clearly Mr. Putin was heading the drive towards bringing those Russian money back home. And at least officially, the FSB or the military intelligence officials were not the ones boasting mansions in Manhattan or elsewhere. So it's a bit hard to see what particular pain will be inflicted by this.
Mm. And so overall, I mean, the United States has slapped sanctions on Russia many times before. Those earlier sanctions, they have had some effect, though.
They did. Sanctions were hurting. They are hurting. And the hope is that the regime will be changed. under Donald Trump. There is hope that Europe will not be as united as before, because we know there are big cracks in European countries' approach to sanctions. Clearly, Russians do hope that this will stop. At the same time, sanctions have not brought Russia to its knees. There is no economic collapse. And I think most of the economists I was talking to for the past couple of years were saying that it was the oil prices crash which did most damage than sanctions too. But so far, Russia was still capable to withstand them.
That's the BBC's Oleg Bolduriv speaking to us from Moscow. Oleg, many thanks.
All right. All the best to you.
There's a reason firefighters are obsessed with what's called response time. In their line of work, every minute counts. They face one of the most time-consuming jobs when they arrive on the scene. They've got to size up the situation, find the source of the fire, and get any victims who are inside outside. Craig Miller from Here and Now contributor KQED reports on two emerging technologies that could save time, lives, and property.
Come on in, Craig.
Don't be bashful.
I'm going into this with my eyes wide open, but I can't see a thing.
Just trying to find the stairs.
We're ascending a training tower outside a firehouse in Mill Valley, just north of San Francisco.
Don't get hurt either.
It's broad daylight outside, but in here, with the smoke machine churning out dense clouds on the upper level, it's impossible to see anything. They're using a harmless training smoke. It's the only reason we can breathe without masks.
Welcome to our world.
Wow.
Holy cow. It's much hotter.
Yeah.
That's Pete Falk, a firefighter with the South Marin Fire District. There's nothing like standing here in complete blindness to understand what firefighters and those trapped in burning buildings are up against.
You could be standing right next to me. I would have no idea.
Turns out he was standing right next to me. Then he pulls out something like a comic book ray gun with a small screen, and suddenly details of the room are illuminated, including a motionless human form in the corner.
So the thermal imager, it's all like relative, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the outside is colder than him, so he's going to turn white. White means hot.
A firefighter appears at the window, again, visible only through the heat gun. We can hear him breathing into his mask.
He's going to check the floor and make sure the floor is sound. You don't want to just hop off and then go through the floor.
The victim on your right side!
Whereas video cameras see reflected light in the visible part of the spectrum, thermal imagers are able to see the infrared band, invisible to the human eye. It's like being able to see the radio waves carrying the story. Thermal imaging cameras have been a growing part of fire departments' gear package for years. About 80% of U.S. departments now have them. The logical next step was to make them airborne.
They are shoring up this building, and I was just told that drones will soon be sent up into the air, and they are going to have thermal.
On the morning of December 3rd, as firefighters were quelling the last of the catastrophic Oakland warehouse fire, the Alameda County Sheriff's Office had its drone in the air, using thermal imaging to scan for hotspots. During the sometimes agonizingly slow process of securing a burned-out building, that saves valuable time.
Absolute game changer for us.
Tom Calvert is a battalion chief with the Menlo Park Fire District, which is rapidly expanding its drone program because of the edge it gives responders.
You know, a drone in the sky or in the air above the incident where you can pinpoint over a larger area, hotspot there, hotspot there. Mm-hmm. And you know, direct your resources, you know, right where they need to go.
Though drones were not used in the Oakland warehouse fire to locate victims, they potentially can be. That fire moved very rapidly through the building, putting firefighters on the defensive despite an estimated 3-minute response time. Calvert says fast-moving fires are now the norm, largely because of the plastics and other synthetics in furniture and building materials.
The fuels inside of buildings are different than they used to be, you know, 30, 40 years ago, when they were cottons and wood fibers and all the natural, you know, materials. Now that's petroleum. Mm-hmm. It's like gasoline. The fires burn a lot faster now.
Drones could help offset that. Calvert and other experts interviewed for this story say it won't be long, maybe 2 years, before video and thermal camera-equipped drones will automatically take off from fire stations as soon as alarms come in, racing ahead of the trucks and engines to send back initial data that could save time and lives.
Before we even get there, we can get very good information about this incident, and that helps drive where we put people and what we have them do.
Still traffic only.
He calls thermal imaging and drones two of the four great breakthroughs in modern firefighting, right up there with breathing apparatus and radios. And while figures are hard to come by for drones, they too are rapidly becoming standard equipment for fire companies.
And I think as you see more actual emergency response type incidents where you see the drone in use and the benefit it gets us, it's hard to argue its value, in, certainly in emergency response.
As drones become more ubiquitous, they've stoked public anxiety over privacy and safety. But in responding to fires and other emergencies where minutes and even seconds count, Calvert and others are convinced that they could help prevent more tragedies. For Here and Now, I'm Craig Miller.
It's become routine to hear how an overzealous prosecutor got someone sent to jail when all along the suspect was innocent. This is the story of a prosecutor who used his conscience and plain old detective work to save the life of a suspect, not convict him. And the story of how the two men's lives converged a second time. It began with the murder of a priest. The murder happened almost a century ago. The case was so spectacular that years later, Hollywood made a movie out of it. It's called Boomerang. The story begins in Bridgeport, Connecticut, February 4th, 1924. People braved the winter chill that night to enjoy dinner out or maybe take in a show. At 7:45, actress Ethel Barrymore was taking the stage downtown. Meanwhile, a real-life drama was about to play out in Bridgeport, one that would shake the city to its core. A Catholic priest was stepping out for his nightly stroll.
A man known and loved by all. You might find him almost any evening on Main Street, taking his constitutional after supper.
His name was Hubert Dahme. He was 56 years old, born in Germany. He'd been the beloved pastor at St. Joseph's Church in Bridgeport for 23 years.
Hello, Father.
Hello, my dear.
As Father Dahme walked along Main Street, a man approached him from behind. He pointed a revolver by the priest's ear, fired a single shot, and then fled.
Hey, stop that man! Stop him! Grab him! Grab him!
No one could grab him. Father Dahme died at the hospital within hours. Meanwhile, the manhunt began. Bridgeport police were under intense pressure from the public and press to find the killer. One week after the murder, an officer in a nearby town noticed a young man he thought was acting strangely. The man was Harold Israel from rural Pottsville, Pennsylvania. He was a wispy 20-year-old, barely over 5 feet tall. He'd been honorably discharged from the Army a few months before. Israel had been staying in a Bridgeport boarding house where he met up with some Army buddies. He didn't own much, but he did have a gun on him. It had five chambers. Four of them were loaded. One bullet had been fired. Police booked Harold Israel on gun charges. Then Bridgeport cops interrogated him about the murder of Father Dahme. They pelted him with questions for 28 hours. Israel insisted he had nothing to do with the crime. Here's how the film Boomerang portrayed it.
What are you trying to do to me?
Why do you keep lying, son? You can't get away with anything.
You're crazy.
Let's talk about the gun again.
Finally, Israel confessed. He was charged with first-degree murder. They could hang you for that. The young veteran became public enemy number one. The police investigation turned up people who witnessed the shooting and some who saw the gunman run away. Some of the witnesses identified Israel as the killer when police brought him to the station. And a ballistics engineer told police the bullet that killed the priest came from Harold Israel's revolver. The evidence was presented to the chief prosecutor for the county, Homer Cummings. He'd been mayor of Stamford, Connecticut, three times and chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Cummings was 54 years old. He was an imposing man, 6'2". He was Ivy League, educated at Yale. On May 27, 1924, more than 3 months after the priest was murdered, there was a court hearing. Prosecutor Cummings took his place before the judge. It seemed all of Bridgeport was watching. Cummings spoke for about 90 minutes, no notes. Some people had wondered if the suspect, Harold Israel, was a victim of circumstance, so Prosecutor Cummings had done his own investigation. That day in court, he methodically cited every scrap of evidence and tore it to shreds. Cummings had gone to the scene of the crime at night. He determined that people who saw the killer could not have identified him running away. The light was too dim. Cummings had hired 6 ballistics experts. They told him the bullet that killed Father Dame could not have come from the gun found on the accused Harold Israel. The marks on the bullet weren't right. And what about the fact that Israel confessed to the crime? Doctors blamed it on Israel's exhaustion. In fact, once Israel did get rest, he again insisted he was innocent. And that's what Prosecutor Cummings concluded. Harold Israel was not the killer. Charges dropped, case closed. The prosecutor had defended the suspect. Homer Cummings was celebrated for resisting the pressure to convict. Future Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter told Cummings that the case would live in the annals as a standard by which prosecutors would be judged. Harold Israel wasn't in court the day his life was spared. When he was told he'd be set free, he said, "That's good. It came out right." No one else was arrested. And that's where the case that's taught in law schools ends. It's also where the movie Boomerang ends. But there's another chapter to the story. This one's personal. Harold Israel, the former suspect and Army vet, headed home to Pennsylvania to find a job. Meanwhile, Prosecutor Homer Cummings' star kept rising. In 1933, President Franklin Roosevelt tapped Cummings as U.S. Attorney General. Cummings built up the FBI and fought organized crime. When he retired from the government, Cummings went back to practice law at the 2 firms he founded. A couple of years went by, and then the former prosecutor received a letter. It was from someone he likely thought he'd never encounter again, the man he saved from the gallows, Harold Israel.
"I guess you think that I have the nerve to write to you for what you have did for me. But you see, I have to write to someone. I'm out of work about 3 years, and it looks like I can't get any work down here because everywhere I go, they say no. So I don't know what to do."
He signed it.
"Your friend, Harold Israel."
Homer Cummings wrote back within a week. He was kind, but said he wasn't sure how he could help. Then 5 more years passed, and Hollywood came calling. It was 1946. Homer Cummings asked FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to find out how Harold Israel was faring, and Hoover reported back. Israel, the one-time murder suspect, had become a family man, a hard worker and a trustee in his church in the village of Gilberton, Pennsylvania. Cummings welcomed the news. The former prosecutor negotiated with the producers to pay Israel $18,000 for the rights to his story. That would be about $250,000 today. A nice take for a coal worker raising a family in a small town. Gilberton was a company town, a coal company that owned most of the land in the village. Harold Israel worked at the coal yard 7 days a week for a sum of $60. He lived in a simple duplex on an unpaved road. Some of Israel's descendants still live nearby. We went to Gilberton to meet them at the home of Israel's granddaughter, Darlene Friel.
"Hi, I'm Lisa. How are you?"
"Good, how are you?"
"Okay."
We brought something we knew the Israel descendants would want to see. Transcripts of letters we learned about while researching the story. The letters had gone back and forth from the Israel family in Pennsylvania to the grand East Coast home of Attorney Cummings. The Israel grandkids knew the letters existed, but they'd never read them. The first letter was written by their grandmother, Olive, that's Harold Israel's wife. She had written to the former prosecutor, Homer Cummings, to thank him for securing the money from the film. Lisa, do you want to read this?
"We can't begin to thank you enough for what you have done for us."
Lisa Barrier is one of the Israel grandchildren.
"I keep asking my husband, are you sure it is true? He just laughs at me and says, sure it is. To him, Homer Cummings, you are next to God. He worships you."
Barrier and the rest of the Israel family have always known about their grandfather Harold's brush with the law, but not from him. Here's Israel's granddaughter, Darlene Friel.
"It was always Graham.
Yeah.
He never talked about that. I think that was one part of his life that he didn't want to dwell on or think of."
As the years went by, there were many more letters between Olive Israel and Homer Cummings, 10 years worth. Olive, or Graham, often asked the former prosecutor for advice. In one letter, she wondered if she and Harold were spending their movie payout too lavishly. They'd bought a used Chevy, planned to put a bathroom inside the house, and each get a new set of teeth. Homer Cummings wrote her back.
"I note the description of the expenditures you're making, and it seems to me that they are entirely justified."
The correspondence continued.
"We've built an extra room on our home. The boys love to read funny books and play records, so this room will be used real hard."
The former prosecutor, Homer Cummings, had a small family. He'd married four times, he became a widower twice, and divorced twice. He had just one grandson, but the dynamics of divorce kept the Cummings family members distant. Meanwhile, Cummings' relationship with the Israels grew warmer. He sent gifts to the Israel home in Pennsylvania, pearls and perfumes for Olive, a set of lamps for the house, baby clothes his wife knit for the Israel grandchildren.
You're getting together quite a family, and I hope that happiness and content follow you all the days of your life.
That family is grateful to Homer Cummings to this day for his kindness and for his courage in the courtroom when he eviscerated the prosecution's own evidence and exonerated their grandfather. Homer Cummings wrote his last letter to the Israels in 1956, 32 years after he and Harold met following the murder. 2 months later, Cummings died at the age of 86. There's a list of dozens of people who sent flowers to the Cummings funeral. Among them, a Supreme Court justice, a college president, an ambassador, and Mr. and Mrs. Harold Israel, Gilberton, Pennsylvania. A final thank you from the one-time murder defendant to the prosecutor who saved his life. Harold Israel died 8 years later of black lung disease, the scourge of the coal worker. He was 60 years old. The man who murdered Father Dahmé was never caught. Today, Connecticut authorities say that's a tragedy, but not as great a tragedy as convicting the wrong man. This story was produced by Lynn Joliker in partnership with reporter Ken Armstrong and the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization that reports on criminal justice. For a link to the Marshall Project's story on the case, go to our website, hereandnow.org. You can also link to the story in the current issue of Smithsonian Magazine.
Of course, it's New Year's Eve tomorrow when we bid adieu to 1 year and toast to a new. And in case you are the one called upon to do the honors, we've got you covered. Jeremy Hobson recently spoke with Maureen Zappala, an internationally recognized distinguished Toastmaster with the public speaking and leadership organization Toastmasters International, about the art of the toast.
One of the things when I coach people, I always tell them, you know what? The people that are listening to you want you to succeed. So relax. It's not about you. It's not about what you look like, what you sound like. Forget about all that. Just think, I have something, a gift that I want to give the audience. And if you look at it like that, it tends to diffuse a lot of the tension.
What if you don't know your audience?
Most times, if you've been invited to give a toast, you know the event organizer, you know the person being honored. Maybe it's a community event or an organization that you're a part of that you have some familiarity with. That's your foundation from where you build your toast. And if you don't know the audience, I always say use decorum. Don't say anything that could possibly offend people. Don't use raw humor. Don't get political. Don't get sexual. Don't get religious. Unless it's a religious event, then you certainly can. But just always, use discretion. Most people know where that boundary is. Don't go past it, especially if you don't know your audience. But if you do know the people that invited you or the person being honored, that's where you start. You say something complimentary about the organizers or about the uniqueness of the event. Because a toast really is a way to build a bridge of identity between you and the organization, the event, or the person being honored.
When I looked it up online, I Googled how to give a good toast. And the first thing that comes up is don't even think about winging it. Do you agree with that advice?
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yes. That's a train wreck just waiting to happen. For many reasons, you'll start to wander. You'll say something that you wish you hadn't said. You'll go on and on and on. So many reasons to not do it. But on the opposite end of the spectrum is to robo-toast it. Write it down, script it, memorize it, and deliver it as if you were reading it. Anybody could have delivered that toast. You want a toast to be personal. Think ahead of what you're going to say. Maybe write out a few bullet points. Maybe if you're really freaking out about it, write out a script and rehearse it. But don't memorize it. Internalize it.
What if you don't have the opportunity to write it in advance and practice it because it's one of those situations where, let's say you're at a holiday dinner this year and somebody just says, Well, Jeremy, why don't you say a few words? What do you do then?
First of all, you know, maybe you could just simply say, no, I'm not comfortable, but I'm always up for a challenge. So then just keep it short. Acknowledge the person who is being honored or the event. Maybe pull a quote out of the back of your mind. Maybe give your heartfelt reaction. I am so thankful to be here with all of you. As I look around and I see your smiling faces, it just makes me feel so wonderful to be a part of this group. Would you raise your glass in a toast? Keep it short and sweet. Doesn't have to be more than 30 seconds.
That was Maureen Zappala, a distinguished Toastmaster and president of High Altitude Strategies, speaking to Jeremy Hobson. This week, two speeches seemed to mark a low point in U.S.-Israel relations. First, Secretary of State John Kerry said Israel and Israeli settlements are undermining prospects for peace in the Middle East. Then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fired back, saying Israelis do not need to be lectured about peace. So how much could the current climate change after January 20th? Well, for his part, President-elect Donald Trump told reporters this week that he thinks Israel is being treated, quote, very, very unfairly. And David Friedman, the man Trump has tapped as the new American ambassador to Israel, he himself is an intense supporter of the Israeli settler movement. So let's take a closer look at Friedman, his policies, his experience, and his relationship with the president-elect. Josh Letterman, White House correspondent for the Associated Press, has written about Friedman, and he joins us now via Skype. Josh, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks. Great to join you, Meghna.
So first of all, David Friedman is a supporter of settlements in the Middle East. How has he demonstrated that support over time?
Well, he's not just a supporter in terms of his own feelings about it. He's actually a financial supporter of settlements. David Friedman, for a while now, has run a few nonprofit organizations here in the United States that raise millions of dollars to help fund a settlement called Beit El, which is pretty deep into the West Bank. And this is a settlement of religious nationalists in Israel that housed a yeshiva and also a right-wing radio station and news outlet called Arutz Sheva. So it's really pretty central to the settler movement in Israel, and it's something that David and other members of his community in New York have been involved in trying to support for quite some time.
Well, let's talk about some of the other reasons why David Friedman is such a controversial pick, because so much of what he said in the recent past basically is in opposition to what U.S. foreign policy has been for quite some time regarding the Middle East. For example, he has said things like a two-state solution is a, quote, narrative that must end. Tell us about that.
That's right. He's not a big fan of the two-state solution, and that really flies in the face with what the U.S. policy has been for years. And not only that, Meghna, but it also flies in the face of what Netanyahu's own policy is. He at least publicly says that he supports a two-state solution, doesn't want a so-called one-state solution where Israel and the Palestinian territories would remain one country. A lot of critics of the right wing say that that could lead to a demographic situation where you actually have a minority of Jews leading a country that is a majority Arab after the population shifts.
I mean, just how far to the right is he on these issues? Because the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, the liberal newspaper, says that, you know, as you mentioned, he's further to the right than Netanyahu. So how are Israelis reacting to this?
Well, you know, Israel, just like the United States, is divided politically. And so there are some in Israel, you know, especially those who have been really dismayed by the Obama administration, who are saying, this is great news. Finally, we're going to have someone who sees it from our side. On the other hand, there are a lot in Israel, even people who might be to the right of Obama, who think this is risky because if this ambassador pick is even to the right of Netanyahu, it could end up pulling Netanyahu, who's no lefty, even farther to the right, make him feel more pressured to be more extreme and make it even more difficult to try to get to a peace deal with the Palestinians.
Well, I mean, because David Friedman has shown that he's unafraid of using incendiary language when it comes to critiquing people with whom he disagrees, right? Because he has called President Obama an anti-Semite. What was the context for that?
That was in one of the columns that he's penned for Arutz Sheva, which is this news outlet associated with the settler movement. He certainly does not hold his tongue when it comes to people that he feels are not sufficiently protective of Israel's security. He's called J Street, which is a major American group that is says that they're pro-Israel, but is also critical of Netanyahu's government. He's called them worse than capos. That's a reference to Jews in the Holocaust who helped the Nazis imprison fellow Jews. And he's also spoken out very harshly against the Anti-Defamation League, which is a group in the U.S. that fights anti-Semitism, saying that they're basically morons.
Okay. Well, so let's take a step back here, Josh. Tell us about, you know, David Friedman, where he grew up, how he grew up, sort of how he came into the opinions and the views that he holds today.
Well, for those who might be familiar with Orthodox Judaism in the New York City area, David Friedman's story is probably not wholly unfamiliar. He grew up the son of an observant Orthodox rabbi who was leading a conservative Jewish synagogue right near the Long Island, Queens border. When David Friedman was younger, President Ronald Reagan actually came and visited the synagogue where his father was a rabbi shortly before Reagan's reelection. And even when Trump picked Friedman to be his ambassador, he noted that Friedman had his bar mitzvah 45 years ago at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem. And Friedman later, you know, grew up, became a bankruptcy lawyer, worked for Trump on his bankruptcies, including the Atlantic City casino situation, and became a very closely associated with the Israel movement. And that's how he and Donald Trump started to get speaking about the issue. And he ended up being selected as his ambassador.
Now, I see that he and Trump became close following the death of Friedman's father, that Trump actually braved a blizzard to come and mourn with David Friedman.
That's right. This is a story that a number of people who know David Friedman have told me that they've heard from him over the years, which is that there was this huge snowstorm after David Friedman's father died, and people who wanted to come to visit as he was sitting Shiva, which is the traditional mourning period that Jews partake in directly after a death, they weren't able to get there because of the snowstorm. And then all of a sudden, Trump showed up having driven more than 3 hours in the snow from Manhattan to get there, spent some time with David. And that was when, for David Friedman, he started to view his relationship with Trump as something more than just an attorney-client relationship.
I see. So how close are they? And I ask you that because I see that Friedman has said when it comes to U.S. policy, he has said that Trump will follow Israel's wishes and that a Trump administration, quote, will never pressure Israel into a two-state solution. When David Friedman says something like that, are we to think that that is indeed what Donald Trump thinks?
Not necessarily, and it's a really important caveat that you raised there. Israeli officials that I've spoken to have said, look, the ambassador of any country represents the policy of their head of state. We don't know exactly how Donald Trump is going to be on Israel because he's been a bit all over the map during the campaign. He said he really wanted to be a neutral broker between the parties. More recently, he's been much more staunchly supportive of Israel and more critical of the other side. So we don't know where he's going to land, but we do know that if he's listening to the advice and counsel of the people around him on Israel, he's probably going to be getting that counsel from people like David Friedman.
Mm. Well, Josh, that brings me to my final question, because you raise a very important point about things that the president-elect had said during the campaign. I mean, people might remember that when he was asked directly what his take was on the conflict in the Middle East, that he, as you mentioned, he said he didn't want to answer because he didn't want to show his hand, that that would be poor negotiating skill, that you should be surprising when dealing with the delicate negotiations like this. But given the very heated speeches that we heard this week from both Secretary of State John Kerry and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, what are we to think about David Friedman's role as U.S. ambassador to Israel in any future peace process? And I ask you that because if Trump didn't want to show his hand during the election, is he showing his hand now in picking David Friedman to be U.S. ambassador to Israel?
He certainly is sending a very clear signal about where his head is at the moment on Israel by picking Friedman. But it's a little too early to know exactly how that would play into any future attempt to broker peace. Presidents in the past have also looked to other people, like their secretaries of state or special envoys, to try to do that kind of a job. And we know that Trump has talked about two people in particular he sees in that role. One is his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who's also an observant Jew. And the other is Jason Greenblatt, who's an attorney in the Trump Organization, has been advising Trump on Israel issues during the campaign and has now been tapped by Trump for a special White House position, negotiating the types of international agreements that one imagines would lead him to a kind of special envoy role with countries like Israel if Trump tried to broker some type of peace deal.
Well, Josh Letterman is White House correspondent for the Associated Press, speaking with us about Donald Trump's pick for U.S. Ambassador to Israel, David Friedman. Josh, thank you so very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
In Scotland, New Year's Eve is called Hogmanay. Now, I can say that, but let's hear a real Scot say it. Someone like Colin Blaine. Colin, go ahead.
You are bang on, Lisa. It's Hogmanay. It's the day before New Year's Day, so it's New Year's Eve, and a very different day here from Christmas. It's a day for a party, and we'll be having lots of parties in different parts of Scotland, all over the country, in fact, on Hogmanay.
So that's where you are, because you are BBC's former Scotland correspondent, joining us now from Glasgow, where you live. So Hogmanay has a long tradition, and it's kind of surprising that New Year's Eve is celebrated even more than Christmas, given the fact that Scotland is a primarily Christian country. What is the history of it?
Well, the background is that although Scotland has been a Christian country for a very long time, there was a strong Reformation tradition, a strong Presbyterian tradition that arose in the 16th century around the time of Mary, Queen of Scots. And so Christmas was relegated as being a festival that was somehow not Christian enough, according to the Bible. So instead, the old midwinter festival became more popular. And Hogmanay, no one knows quite what the origins of the word are. They might be Viking, they could be Norman, French, they may even be Greek. But Hogmanay became the premier winter festival, and it wasn't until 1958 that Christmas Day in Scotland was even a public holiday.
That's amazing. 1958, and what made that change?
I guess times began to change, but even after then, a lot of people went to work on Christmas Day, and they would be saving their holiday for New Year's Day, Hogmanay, and the 2nd of January, because that's when the real fun started. It's a more balanced thing in Scotland now, but we still have many of those old traditions. We still have wonderful things like first footing, where people wait in their homes, really fearing to come out. Older people don't want to come out until they've had someone arrive, bringing them a gift and bringing them good luck. It's got to be the right kind of person as well. It has to be someone who's tall and dark, going to be the first person to arrive in the new year, bringing you luck.
Well, in Scotland, I guess there are a lot of tall and dark people. But if you're at home waiting for somebody to come in, somebody has to be brave enough to go out to come into somebody else's house.
That's right. In fact, sometimes folk will make an arrangement. They will say to one of their neighbours, look, you're tall and dark. Make sure you get to my house tomorrow morning, because otherwise I can't go out. That was such a strong tradition among the old timers that they wouldn't leave their homes until they'd had that bringing of luck. And the person who came would sometimes bring a piece of coal or peat for the fire or something special to eat. Traditionally, black bun, which you don't see much now, but traditionally that was the bringing of luck.
I hesitate to ask. What is black bun?
Well, it's a kind of bread, but it's quite sweet. So something that would be regarded as a treat.
So Hogmanay itself, you told us what has happened in the past. What's the current way of celebrating? What's going to happen tomorrow night?
It hasn't changed so much, but what will happen is that people will prepare for the bells, which are the moment of the new year coming in. They will be at a party somewhere. If you're in Edinburgh, it'll be a huge street party. But I'll be at a party in my own house. I'll have a number of friends round, and we'll keep an eye on TV now to watch for the countdown to the bells. And then when new year comes, everybody will link arms in my front room, and we'll make an attempt at Auld Lang Syne. line. I mean, we're not brilliant at singing it, but everyone will have a go, and there'll be a real sense of community. I think that's one of the things that survives. That's one of the things that people enjoy about Hug Monet, everybody getting together.
Now, that's what a lot of people forget, I think, because we sing Auld Lang Syne here as well when the ball drops in Times Square. And this actually comes from a Scot, from Robert Burns' poem.
That's exactly right, and it's very popular here. I have to say, one of my neighbours is a bagpiper, and I went to his flat for New Year a few years ago for Hug Monet, and he played in a small flat with his son and his son's friend. They had three pipers marching around the flat at New Year, so you can guess that everybody knew that the bells had rung.
So you're going to be singing it with your pals, linking arms, tomorrow night. You want to give us a little preview of it right now?
Hey, listen, I'll tell you, I've got to have had some whiskey before I do that. And one of the interesting things, and it is very much a party, and there's a certain amount of drinking goes on, is that the tradition in the Western Isles, where my wife comes from, is that when you arrive in the house for Hug Monet, the householder will open the whiskey bottle and throw the cork in the fire, because the whiskey is not going back in the cupboard. You know, that's the tradition of generosity and hospitality that Hug Monet is all about.
So how do you wish each other a happy New Year or a happy Hug Monet?
Pretty much the same as everybody else. We'll shake hands, there'll be some kissing and hugging, and you'll wish people a good New Year, and many owe them.
Well, Colin Blaine, just retired as the BBC Scotland correspondent, we take a cup of kindness to you for a happy Hug Monet.
Thank you very much indeed, and a good New Year to you too.
And surely you'll be your pine stoop, and surely I'll be mine, and we'll tack a cup of kindness yet for Auld Lang Syne.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.
And we'll talk correct.